You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of July, 2014, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One with me, Nancy Durham. On today's show...
We have to remain vigilant. Unfortunately, I wish we lived in a world where we didn't face ongoing threats and where those who would wish to do us harm didn't have increasing access to technology and new ways of trying to inflict violence.
The U.S. warns non-metallic bombs are a new threat to aviation and national security. Political historian Dr. James Boyes and research fellow at the Rusi think tank Shashank Joshi will join me to discuss that story and other big news of the day. Then, lightening the tone in the second half of the show, we head to South Tyrol to hear from Tyler Boulle, who's holding court with the region's architecture community. All that, plus we run through the day's news in Mali and surrounding region with our correspondent in Bamako. We'll also review the week's books from Germany with Der Spiegel culture editor Georg Dietz. That's Midori House with me, Nancy Durham, right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before that, here's Bill Bingham with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. The US Embassy in Uganda says it's been warned of what it calls a specific threat of an attack against Entebbe International Airport near the capital Kampala on Thursday evening. In a statement, embassy officials say the warning came from Ugandan police based on intelligence sources and that the threat involved an unknown terrorist group. The warning comes a day after the White House announced it was increasing security for some direct flights from Africa, the Middle East and Europe. There's increasing concern that terrorists are developing more sophisticated bombs designed to avoid airport screening. Israel's military is sending troop reinforcements to its border with the Gaza Strip as both sides step up aerial assaults. The heightened tension follows the abduction and killing of three Israeli teenagers and the suspected revenge killing of a Palestinian 17-year-old. 10 Palestinians have been injured in airstrikes on Gaza, which Israel says followed mortar and rocket attacks from militants. The funeral of the Palestinian teenager Mohammed Abu Qadayr, who was abducted and killed in Jerusalem on Wednesday, has been delayed to allow for a post-mortem examination. Medical experts and health ministers from 11 African nations are meeting in Ghana to discuss how to stop the biggest ever outbreak of Ebola from extending still further. The World Health Organization has warned drastic action is needed to halt the infection. It reports there have been 759 cases, including 467 deaths in Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia. The outbreak began in March. Not only is it uncontained, but the virus can kill up to 90% of those infected. Officials are warning their biggest challenge is denial, fear and panic. Ghana's health minister, Sheri Aite, says international help is needed.
We would like to appeal to our development partners, as has been reiterated by the Director for Africa, to come to their aid, to support the three countries, especially financially, so that they can procure the needed drugs and the needed protective clothing to support the health personnel that are fighting the Ebola virus.
New Ukrainian Defense Minister Valery Heletay has promised to hold a victory parade in Crimea to restore the country's territorial integrity. He's told the parliament in Kiev the parade will take place in Sevastopol. Russia annexed the peninsula in March after a controversial referendum. A government offensive against pro-Russian separatists continues in eastern Ukraine. For the first time in recent years, the United States has given details of its military presence in Somalia. U.S. officials told the Reuters news agency there are up to 120 troops on the ground. The soldiers work with African Union and Somali government troops fighting Al-Shabaab Islamist insurgents. The total number of armed Americans on the Somali government side, including contractors, is thought to be much higher. U.S. officials in Washington say the plan is to increase its military involvement with the Somali National Army. The first hurricane of the Atlantic season, Hurricane Arthur, is gaining strength with its outer fringes reaching the US state of North Carolina. Thousands of holidaymakers have cancelled their 4th of July beach celebration plans and have left the low-lying barrier islands which lie in the storm's path. Forecasters say Hurricane Arthur is about 150 miles south-southwest of Cape Fear and has winds of up to 80 miles an hour. North Carolina's Governor Pat McCrory says the state is well prepared to handle the Category 1 storm.
We are prepared. We've got the best team in the United States in preparing for emergencies. We proved it during the recent ice storms, and we're going to prove it again during this hurricane. We're already taking action in preparation to have a very quick recovery and ensuring that we can get back online as quick as possible regarding utility service, water services, roads, transportation within a very short period of time.
North Carolina's Governor Pat McCrory. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The show will continue right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Where are you, London? This is Monaco 24.
Op London, du er Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europa.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is just coming up to 18:07, making it almost 13:07 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is political historian Dr. James Boyce. Welcome. And research fellow at the United Services Institute, Shashank Joshi. Thanks very much for coming in.
Good evening.
Welcome. There is so much going on all over the world, but we're going to start with Iraq. Couple of notes here. As the situation continues to unravel, implications for the region get more complex. I think that's fair to say. Saudi Arabia has reportedly put 30,000 troops along the border with Iraq to stop the infiltration of any Sunni jihadist elements across the border. On Wednesday, King Abdullah discussed Iraq and the threat posed by the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, known as ISIS, with U.S. President Barack Obama in a telephone conversation. And the king's also given $500 million to the UN to help address the humanitarian crisis is growing in Iraq. Can we just kick right off here with the question, what is Iraq doing or not doing along its borders that has made the Saudis step up their presence along that border?
Well, about half of Iraq's army divisions have collapsed, and there is an enormous threat to the north and the west inside Iraq. So it's hardly surprising to me that if you're Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and you're looking at the situation, where do you prioritize your troops? Well, certainly not places where you think it'll benefit Saudi Arabia, which is a country that has no love lost for Mr. Maliki, a country that he accused of funding the genocidal group ISIS, as he put it a couple of weeks ago. You know, he is focusing his troops on the holy cities of Samarra, Najaf, Karbala, and protecting and retaking places like Tikrit, and least of all Mosul. So border defences are the least of Maliki's concerns. He has major cities he has to take back.
Got it. Okay, and over to you, James Boyce, because certainly the Saudis have great interest in that border.
They do indeed. And I think what's fascinating here is you're seeing, I think, the impact and the effect of the Iraqis basically demanding that the Americans leave at a time when, of course, George W. Bush had negotiated the idea of keeping a residual force within Iraq that was basically reneged upon once Obama came in. I guess the Americans in some respects were quite happy to go home at that point, but the deal had originally been to keep Americans in country to perpetuate the defense of Iraq and to help Iraqis defend their own nation. Now, of course, they aren't there anymore to do that. The Americans are now having to start sending, you know, special advisors is the term, which has got loaded implications for those who can remember beginning of the Vietnam War, for example. You know, where does this end? Okay, Obama has made his entire presidency based around withdrawal from engagement, not wanting to get neck deep back into that. So we really are, I think, at a major tipping point at this point.
Shashank, can I, thanks, James, back to you, sure. Shashank. I'd like to ask you at this point, can we step back a bit or maybe step into the situation, but how fast is Iraq really unraveling? Is it as fast as it feels, or are we just getting bombarded with endless bits of information and media from a dozen angles.
I think it is as fast as it feels, with the caveat that it won't keep unravelling at this speed because of Iraq's sectarian demography. And let me just clarify, ISIS has taken over perhaps up to half of Iraqi cities. So let's make no mistake, this is a seriously powerful group. This is not just a flash in the pan. However, as it pushes further south, it will run into Shia majority areas. It has only been able to conquer cities at the pace it has because of support from two different sets of people, local Sunni tribes who are angry at Baghdad and what they see as a Shia-dominated government, and former Baathists, militias run by people who are loyal to Saddam and have been hunkering down for years. As ISIS pushes further south, it will not be able to enjoy the support of those groups because it will run into Shia-majority areas who will... They've had just about enough of Sunni-sponsored attacks on their people for years. They will fight back. But make no mistake, Iraq is crumbling. It's crumbled fast. It will probably take years before the North and West come back into Baghdad's hands.
James?
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see, you know, as Shashank rightly points out, whether it will continue heading that way or whether it will move in different directions. Of course, there's great fears about what could happen if it pushes over into towards the Jordanian border, for example. If you end up with threats to the Jordanian monarchy, will that, you know, draw Americans in further? For many, many years, those of us in academia used to talk about the threat from non-state actors. Now, all of a sudden, it seems that a non-state actor is about to assume, you know, most state-level implications, you know, and what the long-term implications for that could be, both theoretically and practically, are very difficult to foresee at this point.
And as ever, the civilian population just in dire situation. We have 1 million Iraqis in the past month out of their homes, and how many killed? It's desperate. So we've got the money from the King Abdullah next door.
And what's particularly tragic is so many of these Iraqis were refugees 10 years ago into Syria. They then became refugees for the second time when the civil war in Syria began. And now they will also be refugees for a third time. And the long-term consequences of these refugee populations moving about is so, so grave, as you suggest.
Let's move along a little bit, if we can. It's all of these stories, I think, are quite connected. Security is being tightened up in the United States and indeed at airports across around the world, with the American officials claiming Syria and Yemen-based militants have developed a new anti-metallic bomb. It's going to be very, very difficult to detect at airports. And of course, but the authorities are saying that the U.S. is going to be the target here. So how significant is this warning today?
Well, I think the significant because it's an old threat taking on new clothes. We've already seen Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen, AQAP, use those sort of undetectable bombs before, try and use them. 2012 being the most significant example when it managed to smuggle one of these bombs out the country.
In a package. Was it in an airplane?
Well, the package was 2010, I think, or later, okay, perhaps. But there certainly was a subsequent attempt at the package wasn't, that was a detectable conventional bomb. But what AQAP developed was a bomb that couldn't be picked up on a metal detector. The danger now is that those old bomb makers, particularly a guy called Ibrahim al-Assiri, who's AQAP's bomb mastermind, is working with al-Qaeda's Syrian branch, Jabhat al-Nusra, which of course has fallen out of attention because of ISIS, but it's still there, really powerful. And it's a confluence of those two al-Qaedas, one in Yemen, one in Syria, that I think is causing so much concern now.
James?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I flew back from the United States on Tuesday, and if anything, I thought the security had actually been reduced in contrast to previous flights, especially considering I was flying out of the United States, where American airport security is particularly tight. I wasn't asked to take my shoes off, for example. They weren't interested in my iPad, in my luggage, for example. So that the fact that this has come out 48 hours after I've just stepped off a plane is quite interesting. How much tighter can this get? I mean, you go through body scanners now.
To touch on the question, how far can it get? Ibrahim al-Assiri developed a bomb that he smuggled onto his brother's person, with which he attempted to kill the Saudi royal family. And it was hidden in his rectum. So I hate to ponder the consequences of how far airport security goes.
I can't beat that, I'm afraid.
Well, at some point, I mean,
there has to be, it leaves you almost speechless, doesn't it? But I had noticed the same thing, James. Yeah. I haven't taken my shoes off on a flight for ages, mm-hmm. and I've thought that everything had become more relaxed. I think.
Well, I guess that's the problem, isn't it? You know, we're moving now to what, almost 15 years after 9/11. There is going to be almost a sense of, well, at some point, this is good. You know, how long can you remain at almost red alert? And I guess that, you know, Margaret Thatcher always used to say quite famously, they only need to succeed once, we need to be vigilant all the time, effectively. You know, just a slight chink, I suppose, in the armour is going to be sufficient for someone to get through. And of course, I guess, as you know, Shashank rightly points out, you know, the deviousness, effectively, I know that wasn't your word, but of these people is not going away anytime soon.
Are we in for lots of that unpleasant racial profiling?
I think we've come a long way in 10 years, and I think the United States in particular has learned that there are other more effective approaches. Mm-hmm. And in particular, racial profiling, it was never very effective, but it's least of all effective today when the threat is from vast numbers of radicalized European Muslims, including many white Muslims, many converts who have Western passports. So if it were ever a useful tactic, I certainly don't think that intelligence agencies will deem it one today.
So it seems to me that we've got this news today, word coming out of the States, but it doesn't feel particularly new, but somewhere somebody knows something. We don't know what the details are.
One assumes, hopefully, someone in Washington knows something. What I did find interesting, I'm sure that wouldn't be the first time, I did find it interesting that the suggestion now is, I don't know whether you guys heard this, that the American authorities would now be potentially intercepting travellers to the US once they'd cleared UK customs and immigration, but before they boarded US-bound flights. So the idea that you'd have US immigration security staff working in the UK, but in almost no man's land, I thought was quite an interesting move in terms of where you're now positioning the potential to intercept, what would George W. Bush call them, evildoers, I suppose, as they were bound for the US specific.
Something like that happens in Toronto Airport as a Canadian, right? When I'm flying to New York, all of a sudden you feel you're in New York, all these people mm-hmm. dressed as Americans.
That's interesting.
In
yeah.
Burly men with guns on their side.
Yeah, and they can be friendly, they can be scary.
Yeah, well, nothing's more daunting than immigration stuff at New York International Airport, I can assure you.
I'll say. Let's just skip across to Algeria right now, a little story here. According to Jordanian football writer Walid Abu Nada, the Algerian footballer Islam Slimani has pledged his national team will donate their $9 million of World Cup prize money to the people of Gaza. Apparently, he has said they need it more than us. So, if this is true, what will $9 million buy in Gaza?
I think it's a token gesture more than anything else. There's obviously huge amounts of international aid, notably from the European Union, that flows into Gaza, which it sorely needs after the various batterings that it's taken over the past 15 years or so. But I think what's interesting is the way this cements the idea. Algeria was the only Arab team in the World Cup at that late stage. It held the candle for hundreds of millions of Arabs who saw so much hope, and they performed very, very well indeed. And this is the kind of gesture, I think, that will resonate really sharply across the entire Arab world, particularly now, a day after we've found the charred body of a Palestinian teenager in Jerusalem.
Yeah, it's just a nice symbolic gesture. I think it's important to remember, of course, you know, we mentioned this this Palestinian teenager who's been killed, but of course comes in the aftermath of the death of three Israelis, with obviously with a potential American connection there as well. It's going to be very difficult, I think, to see how this is going to fail to escalate, I think. I know Obama's talked about his position on this as a parent, for example, but he's also head of state. There's going to be a lot of pressure, I think, upon him to move on this, especially with upcoming elections in the United States.
This gives us a chance to talk about the various points of view as the situation escalates between Israel and Palestine. What do you think the view is from Israel and from Palestine? Shashank, first to you.
I think it's significant this has come at the end of a long, tortuous and ultimately failed set of peace talks. This is the first time since the early 1990s that the two sides are not formally talking to each other in some capacity. There is a real loathing between Mahmoud Abbas, leader of the PA, and Benjamin Netanyahu. So if this has occurred at any time, it would be a tragic act that could set off retaliatory spirals in any case, as it seems show signs of doing from each side. It's even worse now because of the rancor that is left, the bitterness by this field a failed peace process, with each side feeling the other side hasn't negotiated in good faith. Netanyahu pointing to Fatah's unity pact with Hamas, a terrorist group designated by the EU and US, and of course the Palestinians pointing to Netanyahu's renewed settlement building.
James, it just gets worse.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's no doubt that there's tensions on both sides. I mean, Netanyahu has never been seen as particularly soft when it comes to negotiation, but I think it's important that, you know, no Israeli really ever loses votes by being seen to be too hard line on these issues. The Unity Pact clearly didn't work well in Tel Aviv in terms of a political point of view. There was a perception, I think, that, you know, far too much of this was being driven perhaps by John Kerry's desire for a Nobel Peace Prize for his own case, for example. You know, where does this lead? Where does this go now? Very, very clearly, you know, this talk about a third intifada. You know, let's hope that these issues this last week doesn't lead to that sort of a situation.
We're just going to make a very short break at this point. You are listening to Midori House with me, Nancy Durham, and my guests, James Boyce and Shashank Joshi. When we return, we're going to examine the renewed focus on immigration by President Barack Obama and look at the latest migration figures in the UK.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
From Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
From Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You are very welcome here at Midori House on Monocle 24. And still with me, I'm delighted to say, is political historian James Boyce and research fellow at RUSI think tank Shashank Joshi. Now, guys, we're going to go across the ocean towards the United States or into the U.S. and try to look at how President Obama is dealing with what he calls a humanitarian crisis in his own backyard. He has pledged to refocus his immigration resources to quell the tide of illegal movement across the border north from Mexico. A reported 52,000 children crossed the border illegally from last October in last year to June of this year. The situation seems to be getting hotter all the time. Let's go to you first, James.
Yeah, it's a major problem, no doubt about it. These are 52,000 unaccompanied children, which of course has got huge emotional value. It's a major immigration problem, especially in those southern states like California and Texas, for example, New Mexico. These are vital states. It's important to recognize, I think we often forget that almost every other year is an American election year. We've got an election, the midterms come up in 2014, when you've got the entire House of Representatives up for re-election. Barack Obama is virtually on the cusp of lame duckness. We've seen results come out this week suggesting he's the least popular American president since World War II. He's actually more unpopular, therefore, than George W. Bush in some circles. He is desperately trying to put something on the table that he can talk about, but this really is a dead duck on arrival, because the Republicans in Congress and even fellow Democrats are not going to be pushing for immigration reform this side of the midterm elections in 2014.
Let's come back to the popularity question in a moment. But why is he pushing for this now? Then
he's going to have something to talk about, quite frankly. I mean, can he talk about? He can't really talk about foreign affairs at this point because, as we discussed previously, everything is going terribly wrong from an American point of view. He has to be trying to talk about very important hot-button topics from the Democratic standpoint. He's been talking about immigration since before he was president. He'd like, I think, to have something to show for his presidency other than healthcare in a second term. But this idea that immigration reform has been something that both Republicans and Democrats have sought to do something about. He's been told by the Republican leadership that they won't table a bill. So now he's trying to use the powers of the executive to push this through. But he's going to find that there really is no way of getting this through on Capitol Hill at this point.
Shawshank wants to come in there.
I was just interjecting, asking, what about jobs? Job figures seem to be the one little bright spot in his last month for Obama. They seem to be reasonably positive.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, how much responsibility the White House has for job creation in the United States is possibly questionable.
Yes, but they would claim quite a bit, wouldn't they?
Well, I think they would claim it, but, you know, quite frankly, the job figures have been rather poor for most of his presidency. I mean, like, I'm not here to defend or attack Obama, but to try and talk about the immigration issue here, I guess. The idea that immigration reform was a point which, for example, Marco Rubio, for example, out of Florida, was very, very hot on 12 months ago. He realized, I think, he was getting out ahead of the Republican leadership. He's had to walk that back now. This really is a problem that isn't going away, and nobody, Democrat or Republican, is being serious about trying to address this at this point.
The immigration problem.
Yes.
I just wanted to give in a bigger picture here, given the GOP's issue with ethnic minorities and it's, you know, having identified the Hispanic vote as being potentially extremely significant for its own electoral prospects, is it missing a trick, really, by not taking the initiative on this issue itself?
There's no doubt about it. I mean, the idea that you had Marco Rubio, someone who was a Cuban emigre, effectively, his parents, you know, had a great story to tell. If anyone was going to be able to get ahead and do this, you know, on the basis that only Nixon could have gone to China, maybe only Rubio could have pushed for this. But I think there's no doubt that the Republican leadership is being very, very timid on this. Their party is split with the Tea Party, for example. The great challenge for the Republican Party is still the old challenge, which is that anybody who is moderate enough and mainstream enough to get the popular vote in a general election is seen to be far too moderate to get the nomination for the Republican Party in the first place. So they really are facing their same old demons, but with a different topic, I think, in this case.
With all of that on the plate, on the table, does Obama deserve this worst president vote since World War II? 33% of people polled agreed this is a fact.
I'm personally a defender of his on the foreign policy front. I think that he faced some rather horrific circumstances on many of the things for which he's blamed. James, I think your description of the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq in 2011 was very deft because, you know, as you correctly pointed out, Obama faced a very changed set of circumstances. Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, effectively kicked out U.S. troops by refusing to grant them immunity. And that's just one example. So I think he's been a little bit unfairly maligned. I mean, no president in 20 years has really achieved any major progress in Israel-Palestine anyway, let alone at a time of unprecedented upheaval in the Arab world. But on the domestic front, it does seem certainly there's a great deal of stagnation there.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, we could have a whole conversation here about the Obama presidency. I think the challenge ultimately is this. He promised so much, overpromised quite clearly. As Shashank rightly points out, he inherited a mess the like of which no one would want to come to the White House to deal with. One had to ask in 2008 who would want to be president that year, quite frankly. And I'm sure there's a degree to which Hillary is sitting there thinking, thank goodness I didn't win, quite frankly, because whatever happens in 2016, it's got to be easier than it was 8 years ago. Does he deserve to be labelled the worst president since the Second World War? Probably not, but I think this is about the failure to match or even come close to the great expectations which he, to be fair, presented for himself.
It's like that next coming up, the Just a Minute game on the BBC, because we only have just a minute to talk about immigration. But here in the UK, a study by the Migration Observatory says government curbs in immigration have meant that the highly skilled talent pool can't get in. 30 seconds to each of you. Is it true we're keeping highly skilled people out?
Whether it's exactly true or not, I know that this is a foreign policy issue. Whenever I talk to key embassies, the Indian embassy, big UK partner of the UK, they always complain. We like what the government's doing in many respects, but they are stopping educated Indians from coming in. This is a major foreign policy issue for us.
James. There's no doubt about it. I think there has been pressure upon the government to try and talk a hard talk line about immigration. Is it keeping the best and the brightest out? I'm sure that at certain levels they're getting in, but I can certainly talk about from an educational point of view, there are great concerns that that is certainly being forced to dry up, which has implications, of course, for UK-based academics.
That's going to be a topic for another day. Thank you so much for coming in, Dr. James Boyce, political historian, and Shashank Joshi, quite a regular here with us from RUSI. Thanks so much for coming to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots more to come in the second half of today's Midori House. Our correspondent in Bamako, Alex Duval-Smith, will run us through the day's news in Mali and North Africa. We're going to find out why international architects are so drawn to the South Tyrol region. And as is the custom on a Thursday on Midori House, we'll review the best and the worst of the week's book releases. I'll give you a hint, they're pretty good. And today that's going to come from Germany. But before we get started on that, here's Bill Bingham with the World News headlines.
And the US Embassy in Uganda says it's been warned of a specific threat of an attack against Entebbe International Airport near the capital Kampala on Thursday evening. In a statement, embassy officials say the warning came from Ugandan police based on intelligence sources and that the threat involved an unknown terrorist group. Israel's military is sending troop reinforcements to its border with the Gaza Strip as both sides step up aerial assaults. The heightened tension follows the abduction and killing of three Israeli teenagers and the suspected revenge killing of a Palestinian 17-year-old. Medical experts and health ministers from 11 African nations are meeting in Ghana to discuss how to stop the biggest ever outbreak of Ebola from extending still further. The World Health Organization has warned drastic action is needed to halt the infection. New Ukrainian Defence Minister Valery Heletay has promised to hold a victory parade in Crimea to restore the country's territorial integrity. He's told the parliament in Kiev the parade will take place in Sevastopol. Russia annexed the peninsula in March after a controversial referendum. And for the first time in recent years, the United States has given details of its military presence in Somalia. US officials told the Reuters news agency there are up to 120 troops on the ground. The total number of armed Americans on the Somali government side, including contractors, is thought to be much larger. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Bill Bingham. Welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. The time now is coming up to 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, and 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Bamako, Mali, where our Alex Duval-Smith awaits us. Hi, Alex.
Hello there.
Well, you've got a few things to talk about, and it seems first on the list is this emergency meeting called to deal with the Ebola outbreak in the region.
Yes, you mentioned it in the news. There's been an emergency meeting started yesterday, continued today in Accra in Ghana, at which health ministers from 11 countries in the sub-region and Central Africa are meeting after the World Health Organization described the Ebola outbreak that started in Guinea in March this year as the worst the world has seen. So far, 763 people have been infected with the virus. 468 of them have died. Ebola, you probably know, is a hemorrhagic fever, and it kills 90% of people who contract it. They get high temperature, diarrhea and vomiting, internal bleeding and external bleeding, and eventually the organs give up.
So what is going to come out, or what is hoped to come out of this emergency meeting?
Well, West Africa has some particular problems that earlier outbreaks of Ebola, of a different strain of Ebola, incidentally, in Central and East Africa haven't had. And one of them is that this outbreak has, even though it started in Guinea, very rapidly spread to Liberia, Sierra Leone, very highly densely populated areas with very porous borders and governments that don't really speak to each other. So one of the problems that's happened is that individual countries have sort of closed in on themselves, kept information to themselves, and meanwhile the Ebola outbreak, which is now in its second wave, has worsened. And I think in particular, I mean, an illustration of this came yesterday when in Guinea a Red Cross vehicle was attacked by armed men. And Médecins Sans Frontières also have had similar problems of people attacking their health centres because there's so much ignorance, essentially, that people believe that Western health workers and Western health organisations are spreading this virus. Oh. So there's a lot that needs to be done. A lot of people need to talk to each other, basically.
And can you just remind us, I mean, it's transmitted just too easily, right?
It's transmitted through contact with an infected person's bodily fluids, so you wouldn't think it would be worse transmitted than, say, HIV, but it seems that a lot is not known about this particular strain, and this is an area with open sewers, this is an area where the rainy season is getting into full swing, and it feels, even here in Mali, where we had a scare, but the Ebola has not been confirmed, it just feels like an incredibly sticky and dangerous time of the year.
Thanks. Well, look, staying in Mali there, the United Nations mission is celebrating a one-year anniversary. What has it accomplished? The UN mission in Mali, that is.
Yes, MINUSMA is a year old this week. It just had its mandate renewed by the new UN Security Council, and some good news is that it's nearly up to strength with close to 10,000 police and military deployed in Mali. But there are troubling sort of signs on the ground of things not shifting. On Tuesday, in fact, a MINUSMA vehicle drove over a landmine near Timbuktu and one peacekeeper was killed. The northern half of Mali is essentially still under rebel control, apart from the cities of Timbuktu and Gao that are secure. And elsewhere, there's a lot of fighting between the rebels. There are up to six rebel groups who all want different degrees of Tuareg autonomy for northern Mali. That situation is described by the UN as fragile. Peace talks are expected to be starting in Algeria this month, but there's very little clarity. And Mali's president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, has said he won't sign up to any agreement that's made outside the territory of Mali.
What about the French? They're cutting back their troops. They came in, it doesn't seem a year ago, but they did come in to help a year ago, and now they're reducing numbers?
They came in January last year. At the height of the Operation Serval intervention, there were 4,500 French troops here. Now they're down to about 1,600, which includes a small reinforcement, just to give you an idea, quite recently. The French have said they're redirecting their efforts to the region, to a regional anti-terror operation, which is probably partly for the domestic audience to prevent accusations of any kind of operation creep. But the Islamists are still active. They lay landmines and they target the UN, the French when they can, military installations in general. And therein enemy is the international community and will continue to be. Some of them, like Mujahid, the Movement for Unity and Jihad in West Africa, are actually close to Mali's own army and government. So all of this places France in a difficult situation, in a situation where, in many people's opinion, they simply can't leave at this stage. And mounting hostility, in fact, towards the presence of the French and the international community, because peace doesn't appear to be as closely visible on the horizon as people had been hoping.
Meanwhile, it is, of course, Ramadan in Mali and anywhere where people are in the Muslim world. And I gather in Bamako, the fast, which has just begun, is making people grumble a little bit about the rising food prices. How do these two things go together?
I know it does seem contradictory, but in fact what happens is that basically the consumers appear to hoard food. For example, I haven't been able to buy a live chicken for a week. We buy live chickens here. We don't have freezers. Get the live chicken, get it plucked and eat it at lunchtime. It's great.
You do that yourself?
However, no live chicken. I arranged for somebody at the market to do it for me. I'm not that brave. The trade is therefore increase the prices because people hoard food, including live chickens. Why do they do that? Because Ramadan is so tiring that people don't want to do all their shopping every day of the week.
So
they stock up with whatever keeps. And of course, the traders take advantage of that because they've already got their shopping done. It's true, you know, people respecting Ramadan get very tired in the afternoon. They fall asleep at their desks. They leave the office early to get to the market. I mean, the whole country is dominated by the whole thing. And then, of course, nightfall comes and everyone gorges themselves with sweet pastries and quite fatty foods. I mean, a nutritionist would be absolutely appalled by what goes on here.
Okay, Alex, thanks so much for that. Alex Duval-Smith in Bamako, Mali. Up next, we'll hear why international architects are so drawn to the South Tyrol region.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Maranushi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the time shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Nancy Durham. All this week, the briefing is coming from the alpine expanses of the South Tyrol region, where Editor-in-Chief Tata Brule and the Monocle 24 team are examining the charms and challenges of the North Italian region. The region of Sud Tyrol is known for being a bit of a mishmash when it comes to identity. Of course, it's in Italy, but they speak German. The region was annexed by Italy less than a century ago. It's also a mix when it comes to the surroundings, from the Habsburgs of fortresses, the Art Nouveau Courthouse in Murano, and the Spartan lines of Italian rationalism, all building styles are here. Perhaps as a result, this region has become a natural magnet for architects. Stefan Rear and Lucas Runger from NOA Architects explore the attraction for their industry with our editor-in-chief Tyler Brule and Monocle's Emma Nelson earlier today.
I think particularly talking about what genre you were working on as we are architects, I think it definitely became a big attraction for us. Not to forget, we both studied abroad. We lived abroad for Stefan and myself for about 15 years. And I have to say, when I left, it was more about seeing the world and getting all that in but that we could. And I have to say, I almost made South Tyrol my home. I had to find it back and grow almost together. And we're both born in Bolzano, but we didn't grow up here. We grew up in smaller areas and villages. So we really came back, and we are sort of pretty much reinventing and refining it all the time in a new way. And particularly also through the university, which is tri-language, German, Italian and English. And our office is just right opposite the university. If you walk out, you almost barely hear Italian or German. It's all different languages. So that was really a sort of an impulse, a very positive attractor for the city.
And Stefan, having travelled and studied abroad and gathered all this international experience, when you come back to the likes of Bolzano and you hear about these great big retail projects that Susanna was mentioning a moment ago, what can a small architecture firm bring to the party? What needs to be done here?
Especially for this project, I think we need to discuss a bit more in the whole population, because in reality, intervention like this, they have to start from the main source of Bolzano, so from the people who start to talk, who start to say even what they need in Bolzano. So that's what it was nice to see Benko coming in and open the eyes to the South Tyrolean people. But now I think we have to do a step back, not discussing about the Benko project or the other projects, but what we really need here. And then in a few months, starting to do a real project. I think all these projects are just talking about volumes and how big and how tall they are. We need to start and reinvent Bolzano for this intervention, I think.
I mean, Suzanne, does that sound a little bit to you like you get in many valleys? It's not just an issue for Sud Tirol or Tirol or Switzerland, but a bit of a valley mentality that people like to keep everybody out as well. So also people are reacting to Benko and David Chipperfield. Some would say, it's great. Maybe you need a big international architect here to put things on the map. This is very good. It'll certainly draw and develop more headlines for the region. How do you sort of read that as a journalist locally?
Yeah, I think you just hit the point. It's this mentality. We don't need anybody else. We can do it ourselves. Well, in a way, it's okay. We can do a lot of things, but I mean, it needs this exchange. And I think what you said, it's quite true. We need a discussion about urban development, what the city needs, what the people want and need. But I still think this investment is really interesting and it can trigger something new for the city.
One of the great sources of income of this region, in fact, right across the Alps, is tourism. And you see them walking around here this lunchtime, right? You just see these little groups, but they seem to be quite local. They don't seem to be very smart, very upmarket. These are the sort of the package tours who know they're going to get good value and a bit of fresh air for a couple of weeks. But Stefan and Lucas, you're now designing a new generation of hotels to appear in Bolzano. What kind of clientele are you trying to attract to the city?
I think since mainly planning and designing and conceiving hotels is almost our passion and our core aim of our profession. The interesting thing about hotels and development and considering the future guests is mainly that it goes away from building a hotel, but much more creating a sort of a new world by telling stories within a hotel. And that is also the sort of the main topics we're trying to bring into the planning of a hotel. We generally always work with a designers collective and creative collective and bringing that in. So it is much more building sort of, like, for example, one example would be a zoo full of animals, and around there is the hotel. So actually, we're not talking about theme parks or anything, but we're talking actually about very, very genuine, unpretentious worlds surrounded by rooms where you can sleep.
Sign me up, if a zoo's involved. Stefan, tell me, how important is authenticity? Because, you know, one thing that we've been talking about in our survey is that there is this great sense of authenticity here, I think maybe even more so, maybe not so much Austria, but I would say versus Switzerland. I think oftentimes when you see new hotel developments, they think, okay, well, we need to cater to a Russian clientele, so we need to have all of the trimmings and fixings that will appeal to someone from St. Petersburg. And you end up with something which could be in St. Petersburg and has sort of nothing to do with the region. I'm wondering, when you think about programming a hotel, how important is authenticity?
We are convinced that the tourism, and especially the tourists in the 20th century, searching the culture of the area in which you're going in. So for this reason, we are trying to design the hotels first, integrated in the landscape, and then giving the tourist a lot of goodies.
Goodies just sounds wonderful. What do you mean by goodies?
Yeah, I don't know.
I want to know what I'm going to get.
You're snowed into the treat bag.
Tyler's off at the petting zoo. I'm opening the bag.
Especially stories. I mean, we don't have big hotels here. We have small hotels, and the owner of this hotel has a different connection between him and his guest. He stays in the hotel even until 11 o'clock in the night and speaks with the tourists. So I think It's
bringing unique things of the area into a hotel by telling stories of design, product design, lighting design, and everything, for example.
Yeah.
Stefan Rier and Lucas Runger from NOA Architects talking with Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson earlier on today's edition of The Briefing. Well, it's time now for a bit of music. We were talking earlier about airport security, but let's say damn the security. Here's Frank and Come Fly With Me.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay today. You
just say those words and we'll take our birds down to our...
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now to review the best and sometimes the worst of the arts. Today we talk books with Georg Dietz, culture editor at Der Spiegel and author of the weekly Spiegel Online column, Der Kritiker. Georg joins me now on the line. Hello.
Hi.
We've got three books here, all re-releases from the early 1920s or the early part of the last century, and they're all making a comeback, having been burned by the Nazis. So what an amazing list. Could we start with Blutsbrüder, or Blood Brothers, by Ernst Haffner? Tell me about this book.
Yeah, it's a fascinating rediscovery by sort of coincidence in a way. It's a book that's set around Alexanderplatz, the famous a square in the middle of Berlin where Döblin's novel also takes place. But this is much, much more raw, much more direct. It's like you jump right into this life of this criminal youth gang that's sort of trying to make a living in the late 20s, and sort of the way that they are treated, the way they treat each other, the harshness, the cruelty, the tenderness, it's all there. But it's sort of... It's not spelled out evidently, but it leads obviously to the consequence that those are the people who are either voting for Hitler eventually or being used by Hitler. So it's all there, but it's much, much more innocent, and in that sense much it's very, very touching novel.
We're going to come back to that. Let's go to the next one. Eric Kastner's book about another gang in the 20s in Berlin again. And we've got Der Gang vor die Hund, or Gone to the Dogs, I understand. It sounds like it might have a bit of a similar theme going on.
Well, this is the story of one guy, more or less. This is a book that used to be called in Germany Fabian, the name of the protagonist. And this is more like Salinger in a way. It's one person's fall from grace in a way. So if it's a grown-up Salinger's Catcher in the Rye guy with the surroundings of the beginning of Nazism in Germany. It's a sort of 30-ish man with certain sexual encounters along the way, with certain things happening around sort of his becoming unemployed and his losing sort of the ground beneath his feet. And this is really a masterpiece. Kästner is most well known for his children's books, Fliegendes Klassenzimmer, The Flying Classroom, and Pünktchen und Anton. And he's a very well-known Weimar Republic writer who, through the Nazi times, sort of tried to get by and did so. And this is a rediscovery of a masterpiece of German literature that had been sort of shortened by two chapters, which were very sort of obscene in some sense, but also cruel, and just the sort of the description of a operation sort of in the hospital. So this is the unabridged version, and it's and it is also the reissue of a book that sort of had been there for in German consciousness, but not sort of in public discourse as much. So it's really a great author to be rediscovered and a great book.
Okay, let's move on to this one. I love the name, Schlump. I understand it's not really a word, possibly, and it's by Hans Herbert Grimm.
Yeah, this is another exciting book that also has a big brother, like Blutsbrüder had Döblin's novel, Alexanderplatz, as a big brother. It came out at the same time that Erich Maria Remarque's book, Im Westen Nichts Neues, I don't know how it's called in English.
All Quiet on the Western Front.
All Quiet on the Western Front, the big, big novel about the First World War, the big anti-war humanistic monumental novel. And this is sort of also a book worth reading. It's just very touching, tender, in a sort of sort of like a fairy tale-ish, innocent way that it's told about what happens in this cruel, gruesome environment, people dying all around, and the description, the absurdity of war is present in every sentence, and the sort of the tenderness meets with the tragic in this novel. And it's really also rediscovery. This author, he published under a pseudonym when it came out in the early 30s, and he killed himself after the war. He was in the GDR, and he sort of never apparently got over sort of this book being burned by the Nazis, and he joined the Nazi party later for whatever reason. So it's a really messed up, very German history.
So we have Grimm committing suicide, and we want to go back to the first author, Ernst Haffner, who absolutely disappeared without a trace. We don't know what became of him.
Yeah, that's what happened.
What a mystery. Yeah. Do you have any theory? Nobody knows.
No, nobody knows. It's like he was a journalist, actually, and he must have been really close to the youth gang that he followed. But what is just sort of interesting about all these three books, that's why I chose them, is sort of that you have this sense of this premonition of history happening. And it is sort of, in a way, my feeling today that you can understand the present sometimes only by either going into the future or going into the past and trying to anticipate what it will be like in the future if you look back. So in that sense, those three books have a very sort of present tone to it. The war, the imminence of violence, which is not present in any German literature that's written today. So that's, it's also those three books, by choosing them as a critique in a way of German contemporary literature, which is stale.
You make me want to jump into all of these, and I will. What's your favorite?
Blutsbrüder. It's the rawest. It's fun. It's sexy. It's fast. And it's the streets. If you walk Berlin, if you come to Berlin, I live around Alexanderplatz. I've never experienced the city as I did while reading this book. It's all the streets are there, and you hear the noise and you smell the dirt, and you see the Jews, you see the gangs, you see the rich people, you see the poor people, and it's all there. And it's all gone. It's all lost. But it's still there, obviously. You can still feel it. That's what literature is for.
And today, do you feel that as a Berliner? Can you somehow summon up what this was like, what it was like back then?
Well, this is the heart of Berlin shopping district now. And this is where sort of the whores lived, where the Hasidic Jews lived. And it all has been destroyed. And it's all as a memory only there. And nobody knows, really. Nobody knows walking those streets. And I didn't. So if what is there is, I think, a lingering sadness that is in this area. And I never sort of understood it, but it's obviously a lot of people's stories that still fly around in this area.
It's just fantastic that these three books have been resurrected, and it's great to hear you talk about them. Georg Dietz, culture editor at Der Spiegel. Thank you very much. And that's it for today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, political historian Dr. James Boyes and Shashank Joshi from RUSI. Today's show was produced by Ala John, researched by Fernando Pacheco and Johan Laux. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next, after the headlines, comes The Urbanist. Then at 2200, The Monocle Daily, I'll be back here with Andrew Muller. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's bye-bye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.